Welcome. My name is Father C. John McCloskey. I'm director of the Catholic Information Center of the Archdiocese of Washington and a priest of the Prelature Opus Dei. Welcome to another episode of our EWTN series dedicated to exploring the life, work, and thought of the Venerable John Henry Newman. Today's guest is Father Ian Carr. Father Carr is a priest of the Diocese of Portsmouth, England, a renowned Newman scholar, a tutor at Campion Hall in Oxford University. He himself received his degree from a competitor or a rival or a collegial university, Cambridge. He has been with us before, and we're very welcome to have him and delighted to have him back again. The particular topic of today's episode has to do with Newman as a writer. Well, welcome back, Father Ian.
Thank you.
Perhaps we can start our program by a very general question. What type of works did Cardinal Newman write?
Well, somebody, a great Newman scholar called Stephen Desane, said he took off where St. Bernard left off. So he's like the fathers, and he writes all kinds of things. And you can find his theology, for example, in the most unlikely places, as I was saying in a previous program. His novel Callista gives you a very good insight in some of his spirituality's most profound ideas. So as a literary figure, he wrote all sorts of things, poetry, novels, satire, essays. He wrote one of the most famous autobiographies in the language. He wrote controversial pamphlets. He was one of the great, great controversialists in the English language.
To give our viewers an idea of how prodigious a writer he was, how many volumes would you say that he wrote if we put together his actual writings in addition or along with his correspondence?
Well, you've got over 30 volumes of the works, and then there will be eventually 30 volumes of letters and diaries. I didn't mention, of course, he's one of the great letter writers in the English language. Mm-hmm.
So this is a man, even though he did live a very long life, and we have correspondence of his probably dating back from the time he's 11 or 12, I believe.
Oh, earlier than that, yes.
Even earlier than that.
Yeah, well, yes.
And some of them quite amusing, actually, for a young man as he was at that time. But even given his long life, this is probably one of the most remarkable writers in the history of the Church. You mentioned St. Bernard or perhaps even St. Augustine in terms of the number and variety of his works.
Mm.
A question would be, how did he write? The actual mechanics of it, that he was a man who was very involved in the most deeply controverted questions of his day, both as an Anglican and a Catholic. And at the same time, he's a man who had a large pastoral work, and again, both as an Anglican and Catholic. How did he find the time? What was his method of writing?
Well, as I say, he was like the fathers in that he wrote for occasions, whether it was a sermon or whether it was a particular comment he had to make or an answer to something. And so he never sat down to write a summa. The nearest he came to that was his great philosophical work, an essay in aid of a grammar of assent. But that really stands unique almost in his work. And even that is written for apologetic purposes. So he very much was an occasional writer, depending on what came up. So very often, of course, it was his enemies, his critics, who gave him just the opportunity he wanted. You know, his brother Francis, who was no great admirer of his, said that he could have been an eminent lawyer if he'd wanted to be. And because he was always arguing a case, he was like an attorney, you know, he was always defending usually defending, sometimes prosecuting. Mm-hmm. So he very much wrote to a brief, really.
What were his particular interests in terms of literature? What was the influence, let us say, on one hand of the Greek or Latin stylists or writers, ancient writers, and on the other hand of, let us say, the writers of the Romantic age of English literature?
Well, he always said that the main influence on him was that of Cicero. Mm. And of course, there were interesting resemblances. Cicero, of course, is one of the great ancient letter writers. And of course, Cicero, too, wrote speeches as a prosecuting lawyer, prosecuting counsel. And indeed, Cicero also wrote philosophical works, and was a great controversialist. So he always, Cicero was his sort of, I think it was Cicero's style, prose style, that influenced him in terms of the structure of his sentences. If you're looking for the English influences, he was very influenced by Gibbon, much as he disapproved of his views. Mm. He said that. When he was young, he tried to write like Gibbon. There were the romantic influences too, but they were more, I suppose, on the imaginative side. I mean, I think that when you read in the Apologia at the beginning about how he was given Joseph Milner's History of the Church Fathers, History of the Church, and he read about the early fathers, and he says it left him with this, he fell in love with them. I think that was a very romantic idea, that Athanasius contra mundum. Athanasius was, he saw Athanasius as a kind of romantic hero standing up against all odds to defend orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And I think there the novels of Walter Scott were very important. Mm-hmm. And the poems of Southey, particularly Thalaba. Mm-hmm. Robert Southey, another romantic poet.
Did he continue to read novels, let us say, as he got into middle age? Or did he, of course, he was living, he was a contemporary of the great Victorian novels, and he, I would imagine, would have hoped that perhaps he might have met or even corresponded with some of them.
Well, he corresponded with, no, he didn't correspond to Thackeray. He was very fond of Trollope. Oh. But the novelist that I would like to make a parallel with is that of Dickens. And it's very interesting that when at the very low point in his life, just before the Apologia, he went away on holiday to the Kent coast to Deal, he was very struck by the descriptions of Dickens. I hope I got the novel right. I think it's Bleak House.
Yes.
Where Dickens also talks about it. And it is remarkable. Newman's letters have. And there's a remarkable passage in Lectures on Present Position of Catholics, his great satirical work, where he's speaking about the English, the prejudiced English Protestant. And this is a marvelous anticipation of Dickens's portrait of Mr. Podsnap in Our Mutual Friend, mm-hmm. the self-made Victorian middle class who goes abroad, you know, and to criticize everything from an insular English point of view. There's some remarkable similarities with Dickens.
In some ways, in listening to you, it seems almost as remarkable that he'd find any time to be able to read, given all the other work that he was doing. What were his methods in terms of, did he, for example, in what is probably his most famous work, the Apologia per Vita Sua, he wrote it standing up at a feverish pace over the course of very few weeks?
Yes, that had to be brought out as pamphlets. Just like so many Victorian novels, of course, came out in installments mm-hmm. in the magazines. So too the Apologia was brought out as pamphlets, and people devoured them at the time. They were so like hotcakes. Mm-hmm. But they had to come out quickly, and a definite, you know, they had to be ready for the press. The Apologia is rather, in a way, it's very unlike his other books, because it's not written controversially exactly. He's defending himself, but he's not, except at the very beginning, he's not actually answering Kingsley directly. And yet, of course, much of the Apologia consists of quotations of letters and of works during the Oxford Movement period, so he is recollecting past controversies in tranquility, or in comparative tranquility.
Mm-hmm. Did he, obviously he wrote in longhand, and he would simply send his writings to the editor, did he edit the things himself?
Well, they were usually sent straight to the printer. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, there wouldn't have been any, I don't think there was ever any copy editing.
It's a stodgy thing.
No.
I thought as we continue our conversation, perhaps we could look at various parts of his work in terms of speaking about him as a writer. I mean, first we look at poetry. He was a poet, as you mentioned a while ago. In a certain sense, he was romantic, a man obviously who had a terrific imagination. You mentioned that someone thought he would have been a great attorney or barrister. Other people thought he would have been a great military general. He was obviously a man of great talents. But tell us a little bit about the Lyra Apostolica, or his early attempts at poetry, and perhaps leading into that, about how some of those were turned into hymns that many of our viewers sing today when they go to church.
Well, Lyra Apostolica was again occasional writing. They were poems which he wrote on that momentous Mediterranean voyage, the first time he ever went abroad in 1832-3. Just before the Oxford Movement begins, but they were of course designed for polemical purposes. He wanted to try and awaken Anglicans to the idea of the early church and to what the church might be like. So they had a definite controversial purpose. The most famous of them is Lead Kindly Light, which he wrote on his return, coming back from Sicily, and it's a very mysterious poem, and when he was asked afterwards what it meant, he always refused to say, attempt to say what it meant. But of course that is one of the most famous hymns now in the English language.
And that was written in part because of a very serious illness that he had.
It was after he had been very ill in Sicily, nearly died, yes. Mm-hmm. The Lead Kindly Light, he felt that the kindly light, God's light, would lead him on to the truth step by step, mm-hmm. and which is what he believed it eventually did do.
Another very famous hymn of his, praise to God and the holiest.
Praise to the holiest in the height.
Tell us about the gestation of that.
Well, that is a chorus from the Dream of Grotius, which he wrote much later, in 1866. I always get that date muddled up.
We'll have to go research on
that. We'll have to check that one. 66, perhaps. It was a point where, for some reason, he thought he was on the point of death. And so he wrote the poem straight off. It was just written straight off on virtually on scraps of paper. I don't want to claim that it's although I'm a pneumaniac, I don't claim that it's a great poem. It's not a great work like Elgar's Oratorio is a great work, which is, of course, based on the poem. But there are some very striking verses in it, and one of the things about Newman's poetry is, and he praised the Holy, a higher gift than grace, that's one of the lines.
Mm-hmm.
That's always interesting, he's always got something interesting to say. And so the poem, of course, is full of very interesting and profound theology of purgatory.
Explain a little bit more the dream, and that it's a person who is approaching death, or a person who's watching his own death, and it's
the person kind of who begins by dying, yes, and he hears people praying for him as he's dying, and then he does die, and then he is confronted with the necessity of purification,
mm-hmm.
Consumed by the quickening fire, the life-giving fire. So Newman presents the person going into purgatory, somebody who, yes, it's painful, but it's what one wants, because one wants to be made ready for the beatific vision. And it's told that Newman sees it all in terms of vision. It's the glance of God's love which is the real punishment. It is the sight of God's love contrasted with the sight of one's own sinful self that really for Newman is the essence of what he means by purgatory.
Well, fairly recently the Holy Father has been holding forth on purgatory and hell,
yes,
and the last things, and it seems some of the things the Holy Father is saying about purgatory and hell are not unrelated to the way that Newman explains what the punishment is.
Exactly. Because, of course, so many people do have an idea of it as some sort of externally inflicted punishment, which is, of course, contrary to the idea of a God of love.
Mm-hmm.
It is, as Newman says, it is the sight of God of love. It is the sight of the God of love. It is seeing Christ's love switched on fully for the first time, mm-hmm, that represents the torment.
Mm-hmm.
The fire of God's love. So if one wants to keep the old imagery, that's all right.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps we can now talk a little bit about Cardinal Newman as a novelist. And on one of our prior broadcasts, in fact, our very first one, you mentioned a favorite novel of yours, which you mentioned briefly here, also Callista. But tell us about the gestation of the two novels that he wrote, Loss and Gain and Callista, and
yes,
their popularity. Whatever you can tell us.
Well, Loss and Gain was published in 1848 and was written while he was in Rome studying for the Catholic priesthood. And he really wrote it to help out a publisher called Burns, who had become a Catholic and was trying to start up this publishing house, and so Newman thought he'd try and help him out.
That later became Burns and Oates?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's a semi-autobiographical novel. It's set in Oxford, and it's about a young man who becomes a Catholic. And there are obvious resemblances to Newman, but it's deliberately set at a later period, and so Newman has some fun making oblique references to himself. This is some years after Newman has left Oxford. The great Victorian critic and scholar Kathleen Tillotson maintains that the novel has a very interesting place in English fiction, because Newman was the first person to begin to develop a new kind of introspective technique, which he does in the novel. It's also full, of course, of very clever and amusing satire.
Could we say that perhaps he was a little bit of head of Henry James? And
well, yes, I think so, yes. That he was
American,
yes,
expatriate in,
yes,
in,
yes,
England,
yes,
in that regard.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit more about Callista. I mean, how it was commissioned, what type of popularity it had, and how it worked in with his own study of the fathers of the church.
Well, Callista was commissioned for a library of historical novels. This was very much in fashion at the time. These historical novels were used by different religious parties to further their own position. And of course, Kingsley wrote Hypatia, which is a deliberate polemical novel against Catholicism. And so Callista is a kind of reply to that, whether consciously or not. Newman is replying to Kingsley. He sets the scene in 3rd century Africa. It's the time of Saint Cyprian. And this is the story of this Greek pagan girl who becomes a Christian. Now, I think what's very interesting, comparing it with Loss and Gain is, and makes it a much more contemporary work in a way, is that Loss and Gain is concerned with a young man brought up in the Church of England who becomes a Catholic, but somebody who is already a Christian with Christian background. In the case of Callista, there's a much more contemporary situation of a secular person who has no religion and is brought to the faith. And so I think the novel is much more interesting from a modern apologetic point of view.
I believe St. Cyprian is the main, one yes. of the main characters in that
yes,
historical figure.
He's Caecilius or Caecilius in the novel, yes. Mm-hmm. And there's a very interesting scene where Callista, who's getting interested in this faith, says to the priest, well, she says, I couldn't stand the dogma of hell. And, how could there be, this God you're talking about, how could there be hell? And Cyprian gives a remarkably contemporary sort of existential answer and says, hell is yourself, shut up inside yourself forever. Mm-hmm. And then Callista realizes what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of the English novelist, what's the man's name, Manner wrote, William Golding,
right.
just
Lord
before
of the
Lord of the Flies, mm-hmm. Just before he died, he was asked if he believed in life after death, and he said no. I said I couldn't bear the thought of being myself forever. It's exactly that Newman's talking about there.
That's
his definition of hell.
Now I remember from Callista in particular a very vivid description of the plague, or a terrific plague of
the locust. Plague,
from,
yes, that's a great scene in the novel. Mm-hmm. It's a very, it's been underestimated, the novel. I think it's extremely readable. Mm-hmm. That's it. There's lots of interesting theology in it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, some very amusing scenes, because Newman, of course, is using the setting the Roman, the pagans, and they're against the Christians, and it is clearly meant to be a counterpart of Victorian England, mm-hmm. with the Catholics as the Christians, and the rather complacent worldly Church of England being represented by the
Donatists or
by the Roman pagans,
Roman pagans
and the yes.
Now, how about Newman as satirist? I think most of our viewers aren't familiar with one of the books you mentioned, The Present Day Position mm-hmm. of Catholics in England, or some of the more biting, ironic. Things he wrote that really, at times, perhaps it's somewhat of a acquired taste, but can make you laugh out loud at how clever they are. Tell us a little bit about him as the gift that he had for satire.
Yes. It was there right through both his Anglican and Catholic periods, and people who think of him as being a very depressive kind of person should remember that even in the darkest of hours, both as an Anglican and as a Catholic, he could be extremely amusing. So he never lost his sense of humor, however down he may have been. Now, sometimes this is used against Newman. People will say, but if he could be so satirical, surely this is, he couldn't really have been a very holy person. I mean, isn't satire a rather nasty kind of thing? Well, I think what's interesting in the case of Newman is that his satire was never moral satire. See, most satirists attack other people's morals. Or they're trying to show that somebody else is a hypocrite.
Whatever. Jonathan Swift.
Maybe. Yes. Newman's satire is always intellectual. It's always directed to other people's intellectual inconsistencies.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a moral thing. The only exception was his attack on Achille, the ex-Dominican friar, who was going around slandering the Catholic Church. And that wasn't so much satire, really, as just a straight attack upon this man who was doing an enormous amount of damage to the Church and telling the most appalling lies. But all his satirical irony was always directed against other people's, the intellectual inconsistencies in people's positions. So it was never personal in the moral sense.
It's a wonderful passage, that is, if I remember well, the present-day position of what Catholic worship looked like for people outside, someone passing by a Roman church. Do you remember anything of that?
Oh, yes. Well, a wonderful scene. There's the scene in benediction, isn't it? And,
yes.
And somebody who just doesn't understand at all what's happening and how easy they can totally misinterpret what they see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people, these structuralists and post-structuralists, are some of them very interested in Newman, because he had a very very keen sense of, you know, what we see is what I see. I mean, it all depends on how you look at something.
Perspective.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
what the text means to mm-hmm. somebody. He was very strong on that always.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he saw this very early on in his career with regards to Protestantism, evangelicalism, that what the Bible meant would mean it meant different things to different people. It all depended how you approached it. Mm-hmm. And when he read the Fathers, he realized that he'd read the Bible with different glass spectacles on.
We will have a separate show dealing with Newman as preacher, but I do want to ask you. I mean, his sermons, certainly the program Plain Sermons, are one of the great masterpieces of English literature. Mm. But there was also quite a change in the style and tone of him as an Anglican and then as a Catholic, as a preacher. And, of course, the great majority of his sermons were written out beforehand. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, it was rather tragic. It's a tragedy, really, that after he had become a Catholic, he really knew very little about the Catholic Church when he became a Catholic. He knew a lot about its theology, but he knew very little about the actual workings of the Church. And he discovered fairly early on that Catholic priests weren't supposed to read out their sermons, as was the custom then with the Anglican clergy, read out rather lengthy sermons from the pulpit. And so we only have the few sermons he preached at the very early, except for one we have, and they've been published posthumously. We also have a number of sermons that were preached for set occasions, so where a text was considered appropriate, say at an important funeral or a special occasion. But unfortunately for the many homilies he preached at the Birmingham Oratory, we only have the notes, some of the notes. There's a volume of sermon notes, some of them very cryptic, pregnant notes which one can read. But the style did slightly, especially the early Catholic sermons, he wanted to throw himself into Catholicism and not appear in any way Anglican. And so there was a certain Italianate influence, I think, and there's some influence of St. Alfonso, I think, his preaching.
I've often heard the anecdote, which is a wonderful one, of a very famous English novelist by the name of George Eliot, who I'm sure many of our viewers have read or have seen dramatizations of her works, who herself was barely a theist. She was not an atheist, had an unconventional lifestyle for that particular period of time, but she was so taken upon reading a famous sermon called The Second Spring that she memorized it, and at a drop of a hat she could recite it out loud to people. Why don't you tell us about this, in many ways is the classic, certainly in the Catholic period.
I didn't know that about George Eliot. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some very interesting resemblances, if I can slightly get off the point. I mean, it's very interesting if you look, because they were both ex-evangelicals, of course. Mm-hmm. They both became evangelicals at the age of 15. Mm-hmm. But they went on quite separate roads. And when George Eliot read the Apologia, she was fascinated because she could see that Newman had started off in exactly the same way as she had, a very conventional, ordinary Church of England home, then this evangelical, you know, born-again Christianity, as you say here. And then their separate ways. But one of the things very interesting is if you look at, for instance, at Newman's sermons, and we've talked about the loss and gain, the introspective quality there, one finds a great deal of the same kind of psychological penetration that one gets in George Eliot's novels, in A Great Portrait of Bulstrode in Middlemarch. You get the same kind of psychological insight in Newman's sermons. So there are some very interesting resemblances, I think, between the two writers. Mm-hmm. But I've got off your point, which was, what was your
point? The means was the idea of the Second Spring, the way he wrote it is obviously a great work of rhetoric, of style, the impact that it had on people.
Yes, well, people nowadays say that it was it was propaganda, you know, and that it really wasn't true, and that the Tractarians exaggerated their own importance, both within the Church of England and then afterwards, they exaggerated the importance of the converts, and that actually the Catholic community was growing in England. Well, I think that's true. It was, and I'm sure it was true. We know that from statistics, but I don't think Newman and his contemporaries had been so much aware of that. I think the Irish immigration of the 1840s and the influx of these very important high-profile converts really did change things immensely. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, historians can sometimes, it seems to me, give a false picture of things, because a lot depends on what the people themselves were aware of, and I don't think they were aware of this. Mm-hmm. To them it was this massive Irish immigration and these spectacular high-profile converts that were making the running, even though the indigenous Catholic population was in fact increasing.
Newman was not a biographer as such, but nonetheless he did write a good number of what are known as historical sketches, both on ancient figures of Greece or Rome, but also many that had to do with the fathers of the Church. Could you comment briefly on that? His work as an essayist?
Yes. Well, he was primarily a historical theologian, and one of the things that shocked him so much when he went to Rome was to discover how ahistorical Catholic theology then was. Mm-hmm. He thought the Ultramontanes were very ahistorical. They weren't prepared to look at the history of the Church. They wanted everything to be very theoretical and schematic. So he was a historical theologian, and history interested him greatly. He himself, when he was asked, why did you become a Catholic, always said, it was because I came to see that when I looked at the early Church and the Catholic Church, they were like photographs of the same person but at different ages. Mm-hmm. And I think it was this kind of, it was something he couldn't prove to other people. It was that use of the historical imagination which had been so important in his becoming a Catholic, and something he didn't think you could prove to people. You either saw it or you didn't.
And so it was a question of seeing and a question of grace, perhaps, yeah, moving you to be able to see that. Well, so wonderful insights, and I want to thank you particularly. You've been a guest on several programs. We look forward to having you back again. And hearing about the various aspects of Newman as a writer gives us an opportunity, which of course is what we're all interested in doing, is helping the viewer to pick up the Apologia or Callista or the many books that are currently in print, books about Cardinal Newman, some of the best of which are written by Father Carr himself, and also many others in order to be very familiar. So again, we want to thank you for being with us. We'll look forward to having you again soon as a guest. And I also want to thank the viewer for having been with us during this time, and we look forward to your visiting once again in order to examine the life, person, and thought of Venerable John Henry Cardinal Newman.